It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here with lots of security news. Next week, of course, we'll have Black Hat. This week, we're just getting ready for it. We'll talk about all sorts of problems and patches, questions from our audience, and a whole lot more. Here's a question. Do ones weigh more than zeros when it comes to hard drives? It's coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 620, recorded Tuesday, July 18th, 2017. The calm before the storm. Security Now is brought to you by Dollar Shave Club for a great shave at a great price. Join Dollar Shave Club. New members get their first month of the Executive Razor and a tube of Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/securitynow. And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code SECURITYNOW. And by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones, your privacy, your security, help you understand how technology works, throw in a little sci-fi and games for fun. And that's all because of this guy right here. This show really is Steve Gibson's show from GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
Leo, great to be with you again, as always.
Nice to have you. We should call this just the Steve Gibson Show. I think it would have done better, frankly, had we.
We didn't know nearly 13 years ago. You realize we're coming up on closing in on the end of year 12 at the end of next month. End of August is when that happens. So, yeah, we didn't know how it was going to evolve. And, of course, it's become, many people's go-to weekly hit on what happened during the week. I titled today's episode, which is number 620, Calm Before the Storm, because nothing earth-shaking happened, but toward the end of the month, as we mentioned last week, we've got the Black Hat and DEF CON conventions occurring one after the other in Las Vegas, and they always produce a bunch of really interesting news, and so there is sort of a sense of, you know how, like, all the water disappears from the beach? And people go, where did the water go? Well, yes, that's because the tsunami is approaching.
It seems so calm.
So we're going to discuss another terrific security-related ebook bundle from that Humble bundle that we've discussed before. I tweeted it to our listeners and already got a ton of good feedback. So I want to make sure that the rest of our listeners who are not Twitter users know about it. I've got a little bit of a net neutrality follow-up from all of last week's events. Just sort of a nonpartisan take on, you know, what I think needs to happen. There was a MySpace account recovery surprise, and not in a good way. Another new feature coming to Windows 10 Creators Edition later this year, but it has appeared now in the latest builds. We're going to talk about the wrongheadedness of paste blocking web forms, which is something that's been going on for years. Our listeners have like asked me what I thought, and I've just never gotten a moment to talk about it. And so I thought, okay, it's reached critical mass. We're going to do that. Also, we have Australia versus the laws of math. Does an implanted pacemaker meet the self-incrimination exemption? An update, on the worst case crypto future model, which occurred to me following some other news. It's surprising what one can find at a flea market. Another example of the consumer as the product. And a little quick squirrel technology update to tell our listeners where I am. And then some closing the loop feedback from people who listen to the podcast. So I think another great couple hours.
Well, we're getting ready. We're going to buckle down the hatch, batten down the hatches and buckle down the helmet. But first, let's take a little break and talk about our fine sponsor. You mentioned you don't like the maintenance of shaving, and I don't really blame you. But I think one of the things that is important and it helps me is to make shaving a ritual every morning, like something I look forward to. And I've got this whole ritual down. I shower first to get my beard softened and wet, and then yep. I like to keep it wet with hot water, and then I yep. put on the Dr. Carver's shave butter, and then I wait for like 10, 20 seconds to let it soak in, and that makes the beard soft and easy to, and then I take out my Dollar Shave Club with, and I usually, like, I was waiting every week to get a fresh blade, and now I'm thinking I might do it a little sooner, because I love the, when it's a brand new blade, how it just, it's so easy to shave. That's really one of the reasons I like Dollar Shave Club. You get a great shave at a great price, and it's delivered to your door. It's an awesome life hack, really, a no-brainer choice. You don't have to go to the store to buy a cheap razor that gives you a cheap shave or spend a fortune on... I knew it was kind of out of control when they had, one of these companies that had like six blades and a vibrator with a battery and a blade. Yes. I mean, I knew that it had gone too far. Now I use my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor. It's very nice. It's a metal handle. It's beautifully balanced. Got the grip in the right place. And the incredible blades that they have. I think Dollar Shave Club is the sharpest blade I've ever used. You might say, hey, that's scary. But no, you want sharp. Sharp, you're less. It's just like a kitchen knife. A cooking knife. You're much less likely to cut yourself with a sharp knife than you are with a dull knife. Same thing with a blade. You want that blade to be sharp. It gives you a clean shave, smooth shave. And then they have the little razor, the lubricator strip on the cartridge that makes sure that, it softens your beard and it keeps it smooth while it's gliding over it. The little blade in the back, too, for trimming. I love all the features of it. And I got to say, I have become a massive fan of the Dr. Carver shave butter. I use that all the time. You can make a smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. You know, one of the features that's weird about the Dr. Carver shave butter, unlike shaving cream, it's clear. So you can see what you're doing.
That's handy.
I know. Yeah. You wouldn't think so. But it is really awesome. It has really magical ingredients, like aloe and stuff. And it's paraben and sulfate free. They say tested on interns, not animals. So that's that's good to know. I want you to right now try it. We've got a great deal for you. If you're new to Dollar Shave Club and to Dr. Carver's and the Executive Razor, we're going to get you a kit, a $5 starter box. It includes the handle. It includes blades, four cartridges. It includes the full tube of the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5. That's worth $15, and you get it for $5. And, of course, you'll be signing up, so you get those replacement cartridges automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees. There's no commitments, and it's easy to cancel. Oh, and I should mention, you also get the bathroom minutes in the box, which I really like. They make a great little publication every month, a printed magazine, stimulating insights, tips, and time wasters. It's believe it or not, it's really fun. And once you're a member of Dollar Shave Club, check around, because they have lots of other really great products that you can try there. I'm a big fan. DollarShaveClub.com/security now. Get that executive starter box for just $5. No fees, hidden fees, no commitments. DollarShaveClub.com/security now. The best way, since you got to do it every day, is to make it a pleasure, to make it a joy, and that's what they do. DollarShaveClub.com/security.
Make it as good as it can be.
Make it as good as it can be. I ritualize it, and it does kind of help, It makes it fun. I look forward to it now. And I smell good afterwards and all that. So
Our picture of the week. We've actually seen this before years ago, but it is one of these memes that just deserves to never die. And the caption that I saw it with this time just really closes the deal. So the caption reads, "We have patched that vulnerability you reported."
I should show the picture here. Let me show it to you.
Gosh.
For people watching at home, you can see it. Well, that's a nice patch you did there.
So for those who are listening, this shows a walk path or a bike path. It's a paved asphalt strip that's got lawn on both sides, extending off it to infinity on both sides. And in the middle of this asphalt path, it looks like a recently installed gate. It's bright yellow, and where the gate is, the asphalt's removed. There's a strip of concrete, so it looks like someone took out the asphalt, poured some concrete, anchored this yellow gate in, and, I mean, you cannot go through that gate. But it's completely open on both sides. And, frankly, the lawn doesn't look like it's in great shape on the sides, and you wonder if that's just because everyone goes around. Anyway, it's just a classic. We have patched that vulnerability you reported. Yes, you said we needed a gate, and we gave you a gate to block any foot traffic.
No foot traffic allowed.
Bicycles or whatever. Oh, wonderful. Okay, so I put this number one because this offering of security-related books is breathtaking. The link is in the show notes. The show notes are already posted on grc.com/SN for episode 620. So you can immediately get them. But it's also Humble Bundle, humblebundle.com/books/cybersecurity-Wiley, W-I-L-E-Y. And the lineup is amazing. There was a couple of years ago, I think it was O'Reilly who was making these available. This, as the URL indicates, is Wiley as the publisher. So we've got, okay, for a dollar or more, that is for just a dollar, but you're invited to provide more if you wish. The book Social Engineering, The Art of Human Hacking. Also, you get the Web Application Hacker's Handbook, Finding and Exploiting Security Flaws, Second Edition. And Practical Reverse Engineering, x86, x64, ARM, Windows Kernel, Reversing Tools, and Obfuscation. And the fourth book, Threat Modeling, Designing for Security. All three of those as ebooks in multiple formats with no DRM for a dollar. But, you know, give them five or something. I mean, you know, and I should also mention that this is all a charitable donation as well. So, and you can choose to which charity it goes to from a list lower down the page. If you go to $8 or more, in addition to those four, Security Engineering, A Guide to Building Dependable Distributed Systems, Second Edition. Also, the second edition of the Shell Coder's Handbook, Discovering and Exploiting Security Holes. Cryptography Engineering, Design Principles and Practical Applications. The Art of Deception, Controlling the Human Element of Security. And The Art of Memory Forensics, Detecting Malware and Threats in Windows, Linux, and Mac Memory. Those five books, in addition to the first four, for $8. And two of Schneier's books is in the final set. There's an additional five for $15 or more. The Malware Analyst's Cookbook and DVD, Tools and Techniques for Fighting Malicious Code. Unauthorized Access, Physical Penetration Testing for IT Security Firms, and one of the first two of Bruce's books, Secrets and Lies, Digital Security in a Networked World, the 15th Anniversary Edition. Also, CEH version 9, Certified Ethical Hacker version 9 study guide. And finally, the book, and I've got two copies in behind me. When I was looking at this, I turned around. One is hardback and one is soft cover. And that is Applied Cryptography, Protocols, Algorithms, and Source Code in C, the 20th Anniversary Edition. And, of course, Secrets and Lies and Applied Cryptography are both Bruce Schneier's books. So all ebooks, what is that? So that's 14 ebooks, four in the first, and then 10 in each of the two for $15. So anyway, I wanted to make sure our listeners know about it. I've already gotten a ton of feedback from the people who saw my tweet about this yesterday as I was putting this together. And a lot of people were very impressed with the lineup. So it's for a good cause. It's apparently doing very well. And I would say take advantage of it. When I looked yesterday, it was 13 days and some hours remaining. So I think that is an end of July cutoff. So it looks to me like it's good through the end of this month, the end of July. Okay, so as we know, Wednesday, July 12th, last Wednesday, was the internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality, which is not really a very catchy title, but that's what it was called. And I saw, Leo, you guys went to black and white and had a red banner across the top of the screen, and many companies did all kinds of things. There were companies who were like putting up an emulated blocking banner to bring it to people's attention or to say, you know, this is what you might be greeted with if we don't have some regulation to prevent ISPs from pretty much doing anything they want to with the bandwidth that you're purchasing from them. So yesterday, that is Monday, just yesterday, major tech companies clashed with internet service providers over whether this net neutrality law, this order that the Obama administration put into effect in 2015, which barred the blocking or slowing of web content, should be scrapped by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, which is what the concern is now. So the Internet Association is on the side of, you know, we need to preserve net neutrality and this existing legislation. They represent, you know, the major technology firms, including Alphabet, which of course is Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, Netflix, Twitter, Snap, and many others. All collectively urged the FCC to abandon its tentative plans to rescind the rules barring internet service providers from hindering consumer access to web content or offering, you know, paid fast lanes. And in the Internet Association's submission, they wrote that dismantling the rules will create significant uncertainty in the market and upset the balance that has led to the current virtuous circle, as they put it, of innovation in the broadband ecosystem. And of course, on the other side, the major ISPs, AT&T, Comcast, Charter Communications, and Verizon, all urged the FCC to reverse the existing rules which were enacted by the Obama administration while vowing not to hinder internet access. That is, they were saying, we will voluntarily agree not to do, you know, like not to break the spirit of net neutrality, but we don't want to be forced to. And one of them even went as far as to say, well, there are some instances where we think everyone would agree that it's a good thing. So it's like, yeah, okay, right. The FCC, for their part, said that AT&T said that the FCC in 2015, when this was initially put in place, quote, grossly exaggerated the need for public utility style regulation while ignoring its costs. And so, of course, what has started all this is that 2 months ago, the month before last, in May, the FCC voted 2-1 to advance the FCC chairman Ajit Pai's plan to withdraw that previous administration's order reclassifying internet service providers as if they were utilities. The problem is, in my opinion, access to the internet has evolved from what was originally sort of an optional luxury to being a near necessity. And in every meaningful way, its provision is, I would argue, no different from electricity. When I purchase electricity from, in my case, Southern California Edison, I pay the same price for and the electricity flows just as well to my air conditioner as to my coffee pot. And this is true even if Southern California Edison happened to own their own air conditioning company. They're not permitted to charge me a higher rate if I use a competitor's air conditioner. But you can imagine that in such a situation, they would love to, if they could, to subsidize their own private interests at the expense of the competition and ultimately at the expense of the public. So the FCC chairman argues that the Obama order unnecessarily harms jobs and investment, and has not committed to retaining any rules, saying that he favors an, quote, open internet, of course, meaning a completely unregulated internet. You know, and as a proud capitalist myself, I would be happy to have that if we also had choice among providers. I mean, true competition. But as I have said, when we've had problems with the bandwidth on this podcast, I have no choice. I mean, there's absolutely no true practical choice for me in broadband providers. In my area of Orange County in Southern California, Cox Cable is my sole source of broadband. And of course, this has been deliberately arranged over time. And years ago, we were covering the mergers of these major providers as they were purchasing each other, dramatically reducing the effective competition in the market. And, you know, some of the big ones were paused or backed off on or stopped. But, you know, there's clearly a tendency for monopolies to form. And I would argue that unless you have true competition, then you have to have some regulation. And there isn't today actual competition so that a consumer can easily jump from one broadband provider to another, at least not in all markets, not in mine. So anyway, 12 state attorneys general, including from Illinois and California, have urged the FCC not to overturn the Obama rules. More than now, I don't know what this number means, but 8.4 million public comments have been filed on the proposal. And the reason we don't know what it means is it would be nice to know whether it was whether that number was bot filtered or not, because we know that there was, you know, lots of shenanigans played with that site that wasn't preventing, you know, somewhat specious submissions from being made. So my nonpartisan observation is that mostly I'm troubled that we're seeing such an expanded use of executive orders in place of congressional legislation. It's true that Congress moves slowly and with great deliberation when it moves at all, but that's the way it was designed to function. The inertia means that things change gradually, only after being examined and debated at length, and that they can be tuned and tweaked as needed over time. But when issues like this become politically partisan, and when the party holding the office of the executive bounces back and forth between parties, as this country experiments with different leadership styles, we wind up creating a climate of tremendous uncertainty, which is arguably the worst of all possible worlds, because then no one is able to plan. No one is able to rely on what the future is going to look like. So, you know, in this case, President Obama's administration put this in place by executive order, and President Trump's is considering removing it. I hope that Congress finds the will to consider this, what I think is a crucially important issue, at length, and will take it up once and for all and remove it from underneath the president's executive order pen, except to sign actual legislation into law that settles this once and for all. Because, you know, having this jump back and forth as a political football is just, you know, it's, again, as I said, it's the worst of all possible outcomes.
I actually don't think it was executive order, Steve. I think it was the FCC that decided to use Title II regulation. Obama encouraged them to, but he did not say so.
Oh, okay.
The FCC said so, and that is in their mandate.
So it's political appointments to the FCC then.
Well, it's appropriate for them to do it, and the FCC, you may remember, tried to enforce net neutrality without Title II regulation, and it went to the courts because they were sued immediately by Verizon.
Right.
And the judge said, look, you can't do this. You don't have sufficient congressional mandate. And pointed them at Title II of the Telecommunications Act, saying, however, if you were to,
under Title II,
if you were to declare Internet service providers as utilities,
right,
under Title II, you could do this. You haven't up to now. You've said they're telecommunications or something. But if you were to declare them utilities, you could do this. He, in effect, the judge said, but if you wanted to, you could do it.
Yes, and I do remember that.
And yeah, and then Tom Wheeler decided, after extensive comment, and that was really the thing that was interesting about this, is the Internet weighed in heavily. And while I think Wheeler was reluctant to use Title II, was convinced to do so by millions of comments from the Internet last year. So that's why Ajit Pai can reverse it, because it's an FCC rule. But you're right, though, that and this is what AT&T, which kind of jokingly, in my opinion, said, we support the Internet Freedom Day because we believe in net neutrality, too. But we believe Congress should do it. And so they're saying the same thing as you. And the reason is the telecommunications industry. Actually, not even that. If you just look at Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, poured more than $500 billion into lobbying in the last 10 years, $574 billion. So they know that if they go to Congress, they will win. So I agree with you. I think this is really Congress is the right answer to this. But at this point, it is within the FCC's purview to choose Title II, and in this case, to stop using Title II. To regulate it, because Congress did give them that tool in the Telecommunications Act.
And so I guess the conclusion is that money wins.
Money wins in everything. But it does certainly in Congress, especially since the Citizens United decision has allowed a huge influx of dark money into politics. Yeah. It's gotten worse. And remember Larry Lessig? The Harvard constitutional lawyer, brilliant guy, created Creative Commons. For a long time, he was fighting against copy protection, DRM. And then he gave up. He said, you know what? I can't win this battle, because before we win this battle, we have to change how election financing works in this country. We have to get the influence of big money out of...
And return control to the electorate.
To the people. And in fact, that was Larry ran for president, and his entire platform was elect me, because you're never going to get elected representatives to do this. So elect me. I'll choose a really great vice president. I will do this one thing and then resign. And
I remember that? Exactly that. It was wonderful.
He didn't get very far with that because of the power of money. The only thing I'd say about
Larry,
that
who?
Is the only reason money is valuable in politics is to win votes. And so ultimately it is still in the hands of the voter. And we just have to vote, and we have to make our voices heard. Call your members of Congress. That scares the pants off them. That's far worse than anything than Citizens United or the NRA or the Koch brothers.
If the idea that they might not get reelected.
That's what scares them. Yep. And the reason it works right now is because most of the Congress people who support this are Republicans facing easy reelection, but difficult primaries should the Koch brothers and others decide to finance opponents in the primaries. They're worried about the primaries, not the elections. They're in safe Republican seats.
Right.
So if people, I think if people started to take it seriously and vote and make their voice be heard, there would be a shot at this. That's the only way. And you know, I don't think we're going to change campaign, you know, have campaign finance reform.
And of course, as we've discussed, we finally have it's taken us as techies this long to actually understand what the term means.
Right.
You have been saying it's not the internet that needs regulation, it's the ISPs. And then that finally clarified the issue,
right?
In a way that, you know, net neutrality has got to be the worst term anyone has ever come up with something that's arguably very important. And, you know,
term. That's part of the problem, right? What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, gosh. And so here we have, you know, the world, or it's, you know, going to be, or at least the U.S., going to be significantly impacted by the outcome. And most people just, you know, I mean, no, we care, but, and our listeners care, but, you know, we're not the electorate at large. So, yeah, I don't know what chance it has.
I agree.
In May 2016, we discussed, so a little over a year ago, the fact that MySpace had lost control of 427 million passwords, which were being offered in aggregate to buyers for $2,800. And at the time, we said, okay, if you were ever a MySpace user, go, like, do something. Delete your account. Change your password. If you were using the same password for all of your logins, then, you know, remember what that MySpace password was and make sure you're not using it anywhere else. And it was just like, it was a disaster. Yesterday.
By the way, I changed my MySpace password when that happened. Didn't want anybody using my account.
No. Yesterday, get this, a frustrated security researcher at a firm named Positive Technologies, the researcher's name was Leanne Galloway, finally publicly disclosed a troubling vulnerability she had uncovered after first responsibly disclosing the problem to MySpace nearly 3 months ago, in reaction to which MySpace was irresponsibly silent. She never got any acknowledgement or response of any sort. Gave them 90 days, nearly, and just said, okay, fine. So she described in the coverage of this, MySpace as being an enormous graveyard of personal data. And no, and in fact, and I was reminded of the term zombie data. That is, you know, like places where we have personal data that we've sort of wandered off from, and, you know, and it's zombie data. It is our data, and it's never going to die, but it's sort of just there and not being kept current. So she noted that companies have a duty to care, a duty of care to their users, both present and past. And in some coverage of this, Leanne told Motherboard, who reported on this, that when she discovered the flaw, she was horrified and shocked by the complete lack of due diligence on MySpace parts. Okay, so what's the problem? Unlike nearly every other password recovery system, which is at least anchored to a user-controlled email address, MySpace offers an account recovery process for people who have even lost access to their email account. And I remember discussing this before. That is, this policy has been in place for a while. It's a little unnerving because basically they're saying, oh, you've lost your email, like your email provider went away, or you forgot your email login, or whatever. So MySpace implemented a system that would even forgive you if you could not receive an account, a password recovery email. Now, at first glance, what they're doing doesn't look too bad. I've got a link here in the show notes for anyone who's interested, since what MySpace presents you with is a comprehensive and somewhat intimidating form, asking for a great many of an individual's details, with a whole bunch of them marked with asterisks saying must, you know, required information must be provided. So the form states that all of the following information must be provided, which includes the email address associated with the profile. That, okay, so right off the bat, it's like, wait a minute, if you know your email address, so maybe it's the email address, but you can't actually retrieve email from it. Okay, your date of birth, the zip code listed on the account, your full name listed on the account, the city and state of the account owner, and there's a bunch of other stuff which is optional, but all those things, red asterisk starred, must be provided. However, what Leanne found is that it appears that some heuristic logic operating behind the scenes processes the form's data so as to minimize their support costs. I know.
Just keep listening, folks. You're not going to believe this.
So it likely has an if any three or more are valid. In the whole form acceptance threshold. So, unfortunately, when you look this over, and consequently what Leanne discovered and reported, and which MySpace has ignored and Motherboard then confirmed, was that anyone having only the MySpace user's name, the account username, and their date of birth, only those three pieces of information, is able to establish themselves as the new owner of any existing MySpace account.
Changing my password did nothing.
No.
Birth date is what I should do.
In their reporting, Motherboard verified this, writing, "Once we finished the recovery process, we had full access to two accounts. We could write new posts, read old messages, and basically do whatever the account owner could." And then they said in parens, "Thanks again to the two brave volunteers who let us break into their old MySpace accounts."
Unbelievable.
It is. Now, that form, which is readily hackable even by its own its owner, does have a drop-down list box selection of whether you want to recover access or delete your account permanently. And there is I've got links in the show notes here. There's a different delete your profile link and process. So essentially, this ups the ante. We already recommended in the past that our listeners should proactively remove any residual MySpace accounts. So if nothing else, this is a reminder that doing so then was an even better idea than we knew at the time, because this has probably always been the way this worked. And it's just it took somebody poking at it to see how little of the form's data actually had to be correct. And Leanne discovered, not much. And why? It's because they don't want to get support calls. It's like if you just kind of fuzzy logic, if you just get it, if you sort of seem like maybe you might be the person who used to be using this MySpace account, that's fine. We'll give it to you. So, yeah, zombie data. If you were ever a MySpace user, it's worth taking a minute to just wipe your data clear. Yeah, you know, because otherwise somebody could easily decide they want to impersonate you, and it's just not difficult to do. And speaking of account recovery, the Windows 10 Fall Creators Update will be adding what is apparently a much-requested feature. They will be adding an "I forgot my password" option to the Windows 10 login lock screen. So where you are prompted for a password, there will be a "I forgot it" link, which There has not been until now. People who are configured to use Windows Hello mode or a PIN will also be able to access the new password reset option right from the lock screen. Once the password reset process has been started by clicking that link, Cortana pops up and will guide the user through the reset process, which essentially amounts to providing some means of verifying yourself with a secondary email address, receiving a test SMS message, or using the Authenticator app in order to prove who you are. And once verified, the user will be allowed to reset their password. So, Microsoft continues to listen to feedback and is adding the things that people want. And I updated my Win 10 machine last night to see if I could actually get that. And I maybe have to use the wrong password a few times for it to show up. I was afraid of getting myself locked out or something, so I didn't see it. And I am on the creator track, so I think I've got the latest. But if it may not have been there yesterday, but it is on the way. And speaking of passwords, a listener's tweet reminded me that one thing we haven't discussed ever is the bizarre and sort of counter, what I think is a counterproductive practice, which some, I mean, brain dead websites have been adopting for now for several years, of blocking form fill automation. And I've received tweets about this for probably several years, not in great number, or it would have made it onto the radar and on the podcast before now. But the problem, of course, is that this fights against password managers. The idea is that there is technology on a website which is proactively blocking the automation of form fill, which our password managers use in order to conveniently provide a unique password for every site that we visit, if assuming that that's the way, you know, we've taken the trouble to set them up. So, and that they're even blocking manual copy and paste. So even if you weren't using a password manager, but say that you had, like, years ago, you started a text file or an Excel file or something, where you just sort of had your own ad hoc database, and in order to help you remember which password you use for which site, where you're used to copying that from your little ad hoc database, and then just, you know, selecting the password field and hitting Control V to paste, but this site won't let you do it. So it's essentially forces you to press keys on your keyboard. You can sort of imagine Scotty on Star Trek saying, "How quaint," in order to actually have to manually enter the password. Anyway, Troy Hunt. This makes no sense to me. And I could not see any rational, right-thinking justification for the practice. But it is somewhat widespread. I mean, I'm not encountering it, but in researching it on the net, I found lots of instances of it, specific sites that were doing it. And so I dug around to see whether there was some hidden benefit that hadn't occurred to me. And I did run across a blog posting by Troy Hunt, who's a well-known, and we quote him on this podcast from time to time, security researcher who writes a widely read blog. His short bio states that he creates courses for Pluralsight, is a Microsoft regional director and MVP who travels the world speaking at events and training technology professionals. He examined this question a little over 3 years ago, so it's been around for a while, under the heading on his blog of the Cobra Effect, which was a fun anecdote about the mistake that the British apparently made way back when they were in a conquering mood. They encountered a problem on the subcontinent of India, and that was cobras, which were numerous at the time. It turns out there were a lot of them wandering around, and taking bites out of the British. So ingenious as the Brits were, they decided to offer a bounty on cobras in the hopes that the indigenous inhabitants of India would round up the cobras in return for cash. But of course, this turned cobras into a form of currency that could be bred. So cobra breeding became a thing.
That's a hoot.
And after the British saw the error of their ways and terminated the bounty, the excess cobras were all released.
Into the wild.
Back into the wild.
You get a net gain in cobras.
That's what happened. Whoops. Which, of course, resulted in more cobras than there were originally.
Oh, of course, the
law of unintended consequences. So anyway, but I digress. Troy's analogy was meant to make the point that sometimes trying to fix something to make it better actually has the reverse effect. And all of us who use password managers would argue that a site which fights against very secure, difficult to enter, and even hopefully unknowable passwords is lowering your security. And so, okay, now I understand why this didn't occur to me. It turns out that the blocking of login automation is apparently, and this is what Troy determined, a completely wrong-headed attempt to prevent automated brute force login attempts, presumably being made by something that's using a web page's automation for brute force login guessing, like some sort of a form fill-in robot which fills in the form and then submits the page over and over and over. Okay, but anyone who understands how the web actually works knows that the web browser page is merely a front end which puts a pretty face onto an eventual HTTP form query, an HTTP post verb query. So no sane brute force attacker is going to automate the form. They're going to bypass that completely and directly submit the form's data to the remote web server for its approval or rejection. So it's not the way brute forcing works, which some lame person somewhere thought, oh, I'll be clever and I'm going to prevent anyone from pasting data into the password field, which will prevent bots from doing that. But that's not what bots do. Anyway, another way to say this
calm
is not
down,
possible.
Steve, it's okay.
It's not possible to robustly prevent brute forcing in the web browser client because the browser is trivially bypassed by making direct server queries. So
I see places that won't let you paste into the field. Do you think that's the same?
Yes.
Misguided.
Yes. It's,
you know,
the
just
same
cut paste.
And apparently, like when companies have been asked, they've said, oh, we'll lose our certification
if we
allow pasting into the password. It's like, what? You know, anyway, it's something that it's been around us for a few years, and I've been meaning to just say, okay, well, like to dig in. Yes, exactly.
Knock it off.
In the same way that the NIST has now changed their guidelines to say there is no point in forcing people to change their password every month, please, there is no benefit to blocking pasting into password fields. It doesn't prevent any actual attack on your server because it's only the web page which no bot is going to fill in.
Right.
It's going to issue
exactly. Yeah, post the data. It's much faster.
Exactly.
Why? I'm going to type it in. I have written a special automated typing system.
Oh, Lord. So yesterday, while I was putting the show together, going back through all of the submissions from our listeners over the past week, I kept seeing this link, and I kept, and it was about some insanity in Australia, And I thought, okay, we talked about this last week. And so I kind of just kept pushing past it, saying, yeah. Finally, someone sent me a tweet with a couple quotes, which did stop me cold. I said, wait, what? So, okay, the headline on this piece in The Guardian was of little surprise. It read, "New law would force Facebook and Google to give police access to encrypted messages." Okay, yeah, that's what we've been talking about. The subheading, "Under government plan, internet companies would be obliged to give law enforcement agencies warranted access." Okay, yeah, no, still no surprise. Malcolm Turnbull said on Friday, and he's the guy that we quoted last week when we were talking about Australia weighing in, or maybe it was the week before, "The law would be modeled on Britain's investigatory," that's the word I always have a hard time getting around, "Investigatory Powers Act, passed last November, which gave intelligence agencies some of the most extensive surveillance powers in the Western world. Under the law, internet companies would have the same obligations as telephone companies to help law enforcement agencies, you know, for example, in telephone wiretaps back in the good old days. Police would need warrants to access the communications. Turnbull said the legislation was necessary to keep pace with advances in technology that could facilitate crime. He said, quote, "We need to ensure that the internet is not used as a dark place for bad people to hide their criminal activities from the law." Okay, now here it comes. He says, asked by reporters, The Guardian reports, how legislation would prevent users simply moving to encryption software not controlled by tech companies. You know, yay to the reporters for asking the question, right? Turnbull responds that Australian law overrode the laws of mathematics.
What?
Oh, yes. He said, quote, I'm not kidding. The laws of Australia prevail.
I didn't
in
know
Australia.
You could do that. That's awesome.
They got some powerful laws there, Leo. He says, I can assure you of that. I'm still quoting. The laws of mathematics are very commendable.
Yes,
he said.
Commendable.
Yes. But the only laws that apply in Australia is the law of Australia. Now, I don't know about the law of gravity because, you know, that's handy to have. Okay.
What a moron.
Yes, the people handling the legislation for us. Turnbull denied that the government's plan involved the use of a backdoor into programs to allow access to encrypted messages on platforms such as WhatsApp and Telegram. He said, and I'm quoting again, "A backdoor is typically a flaw in a software program that perhaps the developer of the software program is not aware of, and that somebody who knows about it can exploit." Still quoting, "If there are flaws in software programs, obviously, that's why you get updates on your phone and your computer all the time." Oh, man. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about lawful access. So, okay, translation. Apparently, if it's a lawful backdoor, then by definition, it's not a backdoor. It's a handy new feature. Then pressed on whether the government's plans meant it would ask companies such as Facebook and Apple to keep a copy of encryption keys used by customers, Turnbull said, "I'm not a cryptographer." Uh-huh. Yeah, surprise. But we are seeking, he said, what we are seeking to do is to secure their assistance. That is the assistance of actual cryptographers. Although I would argue that it's less seeking their assistance than compelling their assistance. Anyway, he said, they have to face up to their responsibility. They can't just wash their hands of it and say it's got nothing to do with them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the Attorney General, George Brandis, said the legislation would, quote, impose an obligation upon device manufacturers and service providers to provide appropriate assistance to intelligence and law enforcement on a warranted basis. Anyway, so, you know, again, I just – the idea that they're saying, oh, sorry, the laws of mathematics will be bent to suit the laws of Australia, which will prevail. It's like, okay, now I understand why our listeners thought I had to see this. And I thank them for bringing it to my attention because, you know, it was a good for a good laugh. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this all shakes out. I think probably – what, next year, I would imagine, we'll begin to see this. They're saying that this will be put in front of their parliament by November of this year. So saying that it would allow courts to order tech companies to quickly unlock communications. Of course, now, the technology we have in place now has been designed not to allow that. And so there'll have to be some, you know, what the legislation will have to incorporate a period of time. We have to see how this all comes out. But if it does happen, it'll have to incorporate some leeway to allow the technology to be changed to accommodate, you know, warranted intercept. And we'll have to see whether it's, you know, like from some point forward or past communications after the fact. I mean, this is going to be a mess because without legislation, we've been covering for years the huge strides the crypto industry has made, arguably spurred by the Snowden revelations, adding things like perfect forward secrecy, where future disclosure of a key does not allow you by design to go back and decrypt previous conversations. That's what perfect forward secrecy means. And the best protocols we're using today now support that. So, boy, you know, without any legislation, the technology has shot to a point where, you know, we're using a lot of technologies which are fundamentally hostile to the kind of legislation that everybody, all of the saber rattling that we're seeing, is saying that they want. And it's quite clear that these legislators are not cryptographers. So, yeah, we live in through an interesting period now, Leo.
You have to think Turnbull's got to know better. He's cynical. He's appealing to know nothings. It's just not so different from the law and the law of the land in the UK. So,
correct.
We knew this would slowly creep across the world.
Yeah, and what, you know, what interests us on this podcast are the details. What is it? What is the law going to say? And what are the technological implications of that?
Right.
So first it was a smart water meter, then it was a listening home audio device. Oh, I've just been cranking along and I forgot to
No, it's fine. Have some coffee. Hey, you know what you should do if you're going to have some coffee?
I am.
Is maybe have it in a Security Now mug. Now we have to get your permission. Because we came to Steve Gibson. We have Security Now T-shirts, as you know, Steve, and we came to you, and we had different designs. This is the one you approved, which I really like. It's quite beautiful. It's got Twitter TV on the back.
It's got like binary ones and zeros in a band across behind Security Now.
It's hard
now.
to tell sometimes, but if you saw it in person, you'd see that.
Right. I really like it.
And it's available from Teespring, TeespringT.com/. Twit. If you go there right now, it looks like we only need three more T-shirts to print it, and there are five more days to get them. We don't make money on these. We charge basically the cost for them, $22.99 for a premium tee. They offer men and women's. But we had approached you with a different design.
Yeah.
And you didn't like it. It had your head on it.
I don't want my face on a t-shirt.
But wait, now I'm asking the chat room, I'm asking our audience to weigh in on this. Don't you want a mug with Steve's mug on it? Look at that punim. Look at that face. That's a face of security.
And the only good thing about that is it's a problem that that cartoon is about 12 years old. When the mustache was black.
Hair. Yeah,
that's right.
I like it. I think it shows some attitude. Jack in the chat room says yes. I'd buy that today. Lawn Dog says yes. Aneroid says woohoo.
Hemorrhoid? What's his name?
Yeah, hemorrhoid. No, Aneroid. User X says, do they come glow in the dark? Dig Max says, I love it. Mugging for the mug, a mug with a mug, a Gibson Wind mug for the win. That's a good looking mug. Somebody wants it to be security plow. And Wumper Mill says, you're not old. That's classic. I don't know. I would really like to offer that mug.
That gets my, you have my approval.
You approve it? All right. Yep. He said yes. I bet it'll outsell the t-shirt. Teespring.com/tweet. Get the t-shirt now. Get the mug when we make those available. He said yes on the mug. Our show today brought to you by a better kind of Wi-Fi, Eero, and the new Eeros especially are spectacular. They've made the Eero base station now tri-band, which means it uses 2.5 gigahertz and 1 2.5 gigahertz band. It's twice as fast, 2x2 MIMO, so more antennas, and they've got these new Eero beacons. So I replaced my Eero setup of 5 old Eeros with 1 new Eero base station and 2 beacons. It's better. It's faster. We have a big home, too, 4,500 square feet. It's amazing. These beacons plug right into the wall. I love it because they're also nightlights. So I put them in my hall because it lights up the wall. Eero has changed how Wi-Fi works. This was, I think, one of the very first consumer-grade mesh Wi-Fis. They are fantastic. You download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device. It'll walk you through every step. Actually, let me get my my iPad over here, and I can show you, because I have the Eero software for our house on here. This is so awesome. Let me just launch Eero, E-E-R-O. One of the things you can do with the Eero is you can designate, you can nickname every device. And you see what devices are on your, maybe it's on this. I have 2 iPads here. That's my mistake. You can see what's on your network. And you can name them. What I also like is you can assign them to somebody. So I went through the house and assigned all the devices to either me or Michael or Lisa. These are our family profiles. Notice the little pause button next to each name. If I want to pause Michael, our 14-year-old's Wi-Fi, maybe it's time to go to bed, it's paused. All of his devices are now disconnected, but ours still work just fine. There's more to it than that. The new Eero, let's turn it back on here. You can set scheduled pauses. You can see what devices are assigned, the game machine, the Apple, all of that. You can also use this new Eero Plus, and I immediately subscribe to this because it has safe filters, safe search, adult content, illegal or criminal, violent. You assign that per user, so the kids have filters, the adults don't. You also have, for everybody, malware filtering, ransomware filtering, some great security on this. Eero is fantastic. I am one of the things about these new mesh systems is they're updated regularly. They pay attention to security, and they give you new capabilities all the time. Eero recently added internet bandwidth tests, so periodically they test the bandwidth to see how it's doing. These are my 3 Eeros. You see they're green. That means that they're operating. You can even see how their connection, how good their connection is. You can see what devices are connected to which Eeros. You can see who's currently connected. These are the 3 most recently connected devices. And as I said, if I look at this and I don't actually know what it is, so I won't give it a nickname. Let's find something that's not nicknamed. Most of this stuff is by now. The TiVo, my office computer, my S8. But let's pick something here. Amazon. I think that's the, let's say that's the Kitchen Show. So I can name it so I know what it is from now on. And I can assign it. I could say that's, Leo owns that one. So that's now on my profile. I can decide on a unit by unit basis, an item by item basis, which filters it has. This is fantastic. I can figure out if it's on the 5 gigahertz or the 2.4 gigahertz, which Eero it's connected to. This is the kind of information you want. And it's so easy to set up the network. You plug in the base station to your router. You can have it in bridge mode, or you can have it be a DHCP server. And then you use the smartphone to position and connect the rest of them, and you're done. Great customer support. I tested them. I said, I can't get my I had a server. I can't get my server online anymore. And they walked me through it. They walked me through several reboots, stayed on the line with me till it worked. You got to check out now the new second generation Eero. It's getting better. The new beacons, the third 5 gigahertz radio, tri-band, twice as fast. It's amazing. And, oh, by the way, it's got a Google Thread radio in it now, too. So it supports the new low-power locks, doorbells, and other sensors that work with Thread. Eero.com. Get your Eero system today. And when you do, by the way, select overnight shipping at checkout and enter security now, and that overnight shipping is free. Eero.com. Use security now to get free overnight shipping. Eero.com. I'm sorry, I went on a little bit long. I get excited. I like to show all that software. It's just so cool what you can do now. It's fantastic.
Well, and we know Wi-Fi is a constant source of trouble for people. I hear you talking about it on your,
everybody
on your weekend
calls.
Show.
Yeah. And what's when you find something that works, and I, by the way, I've tried them all. You know that. I have two networks. I'm always putting.
We know you've tried everything. Leo.
This is the one we're sticking with. It really works. All right, back to you've had your caffeine. I've had my ad. It's back to you. We still have one more. Don't forget.
Yep. So, okay. First, it was a smart water meter, then a listening home audio device. Now it's a suspect's own heart rate, as recorded by his implanted pacemaker. And Gadget's headline reads, judge allows pacemaker data to be used in arson trial, with the subheading, the subject tried and failed to get the judge to disregard his own heartbeat as evidence. Now, we covered this story at the time. It was in the latter half of last year. And you'll remember this, Leo, because it was sort of bizarre even then. Authorities in Ohio arrested a man named Ross Compton on the charge of arson and insurance fraud based on his pacemaker data. Compton told the police that when he saw his house burning on September 19th of last year, he packed his suitcases, threw them out his bedroom window, and carried them to his car. However,
that's how they got there.
Since he has a serious heart condition and other medical issues that would have made it extremely difficult for him to do all of that, also in the time frame apparent that was apparently like based on the 911 call and so forth, investigators were able to secure a search warrant for his pacemaker. So there was reasonable suspicion that allowed them to get his pacemaker data. Then, according to court documents, a cardiologist reviewed his heart rate, the pacer demand, and his cardiac rhythms before, during, and after the fire, saying, quote, it is highly improbable that Mr. Compton would have been able to collect, pack, and remove the number of items from the house, exit his bedroom window, and carry numerous large and heavy items to the front of his residence during the short period of time he has indicated due to his medical conditions. And as it turned out, that data became a key piece of evidence that allowed law enforcement to indict the accused, this guy, Mr. Compton, although they also detected gasoline on his shoes and clothing. So, yeah, how did that get there?
He was shaky after the fire, and he had to fill his tank, I think.
Yeah, some hokey story.
Yeah.
So I should note that the EFF is not happy about this, naturally. Stephanie LaCambra, an Electronic Frontier Foundation staff attorney, told SC Magazine in their coverage that at that time that cases like this could be the canary in the coal mine concerning the larger privacy implications of using a person's medical data. She explained, Americans should not have to make a choice between health and privacy. We as a society, she said, value our rights to maintain privacy over personal and medical information, and compelling citizens to turn over protected health data to law enforcement erodes those rights. Ross's attorney, also the defense attorney, tried to convince the court to disregard that evidence, arguing that it was obtained in an illegal search. But the judge who heard the case didn't see it that way. He has decided to allow the suspect's pacemaker results to be used as evidence against him in an upcoming trial. However, something the judge said is troubling. Engadget reported that Judge Charles Pater said he does not think the data's use has bigger privacy implications. But his exact quote makes that rather murky. He said, quote, "There is a lot of other information about things that may characterize the inside of my body that I would much prefer to keep private rather than how my heart is beating. It is not, he said, it is just not that big of a deal." And it's like, whoa, wait. So he's saying that heart rate should be made publicly available, or available in this case, yet he is acknowledging there are other things about his body that he doesn't, want to have available. So it seems to me I'll be surprised, for example, if this got appealed, if that on the record statement wasn't used to say, wait a minute, the judge is just making an arbitrary decision that pacemaker data is acceptable, but other things like what? Maybe your insulin pump data, for example, would not be. I don't know. It just seems to me that we need, again, some clear legislation about what is private and what's not. And, I am glad we had the EFF watching this stuff and often stepping in on our behalf. Tech Dirt has a writer, Carl Bode, who posted yesterday under the topic of the misuses of technology. And some of this is all sort of already on the record for us, but it triggered some additional thinking that I wanted to share with our listeners. So I want to share his reporting and then further stretch our thinking about the possible future of internet encryption. Carl wrote, the global war against privacy tools, VPNs, and encryption continues utterly unhinged from common sense. And he writes, the assault on consumer privacy remains a notably global affair. Reddit users noticed that India's fifth largest ISP, YOU Broadband, is among several of the country's ISPs that have been trying to prevent customers from using meaningful encryption. According to the company's updated terms of service, as a customer of the ISP, you're supposed to avoid using encryption to allow for easier monitoring of your online behavior. Quote, the customer, says the terms of service, quote, the customer shall not take any steps, including adopting any encryption system, that prevents or in any way hinders the company from maintaining a log of the customer, or maintaining or having access to copies of all packages/data originating from the customer. And then Carl writes, of course, enforcement of such a requirement is largely impossible. Okay, now this is what I will address in a minute, because it's actually and significantly incorrect as a consequence of some additional thinking I've done. But he writes, YOU Broadband isn't just being randomly obtuse. And while the ISP's terms of service is making headlines, this effort isn't really new. He writes, most Indian ISPs are simply adhering to a misguided and still not adequately updated set of 2007 guidelines, so 10 years old, imposed by India's Department of Telecommunications, demanding that ISPs try to prevent their subscribers from using any encryption with greater than a 40-bit key length if they want to do business in India. Quoting from the terms of service, the licensee shall ensure that bulk encryption is not deployed by ISPs connecting to landing station. Further, individuals, groups, organizations are permitted to use encryption up to 40-bit key length in the symmetric key algorithms or its equivalent in other algorithms without having to obtain permission from licensor. However, if encryption equipments higher than this limit are to be deployed, individuals, groups, organizations shall do so with the prior written permission of the licensor and deposit the decryption key split into two parts with the licensor. Okay, so then Carl says, which is and of itself rather hysterical, since given that since 1996 or so, most folks have considered a 40-bit key length to be the security equivalent of wet tissue paper. In fact, Ian Goldberg, and we talked about this at the time, won $100,000 from RSA for breaking 40-bit encryption in just a few hours way back in 1997, saying at the time, this is the final proof of what we've known for years, 40-bit encryption technology is obsolete. So, so first of all, you know, on the question of is this possible, well, what we know of the way web browsers and servers establish their connection is that by necessity, there is a plain text handshake which occurs between the client and the server or any endpoints in a secure TLS connection before the encrypted tunnel is brought up in order to begin encrypting traffic. And we've often talked about how the one of the reasons that browsers and servers have deprecated 40-bit keys and the use of 40-bit symmetric ciphers is that it was possible for an attacker to create a downgrade attack because that handshake is by necessity in the clear. The client sends a list of all the ciphers it knows to the server. And if a man in the middle were to edit that list, removing the higher security ciphers and leaving only the 40-bit ciphers, then the server would receive this sad list of available security and shrug to itself and go, well, okay, and agree to establish a 40-bit connection. The client would think, wow, because the client wouldn't be aware that its handshake had been edited in on the fly. It would think, wow, this must be a lame server. I offered all these great ciphers, and the server apparently just can only do 40 bits. Oh, well. And so they would then negotiate a 40-bit connection, which we now know, if that was captured, could in a relatively short amount of time be cracked. And historically, this was so-called export-grade encryption. The good news is, for years we suffered under the previous use of export-grade grade encryption. It just stayed around for the sake of backward compatibility to endpoints that couldn't do any better. Finally, over the last few years, as we've moved forward, it has been dropped across the board. So currently that could not be done. But what could be done if somebody wished to would be that an ISP could first of all require their customers to use browsers with this degenerate form of encryption, or we know the ISP could themselves set themselves up as a so-called middle box in order to intercept more secure connections, decrypt them on the fly, perform so-called deep packet inspection, and then re-encrypt as it goes to the server. Now, until recently, I have been suggesting that that what this would require is that an ISP's customer, accept a certificate from the ISP. Because, for example, that's what the existing middle boxes do that are used in enterprise settings. That middle box has its own certificate, and all of the PCs within the organization have that cert added, the public key matching the private key that the middle box is using, have that added to their trusted root store so that their connections can be intercepted and analyzed for malware and content protection in order to help secure the corporate intranet against the fact that now most traffic is encrypted. So that's the way those work. But it's not – and so the other problem in terms of a practical solution is that how can an ISP ask all of their customers to do that? And what about IoT devices, which have – may have a non-editable fixed firmware set of root certificates if they're even using TLS? Of course, if they're not, then it's not a problem. But what I, in thinking about this further, I realized that, for example, Google is able to mint their own certificates. They're able to do that because they have a certificate which they got from Global Trust, which is itself a certificate authority. It's an intermediate certificate, but unlike most intermediate certificates, it has the permission bits set because it obtained them from Global Trust to itself be a certificate authority and create its own certificates. So the one scenario here is that in the future, ISPs might be established in the same way that Google has established themselves, such that an ISP would receive a certificate which is already trusted by all of the trust stores in all of our devices. And unlike typical intermediate certificates, it would be a certificate authority certificate, allowing its interception hardware to seamlessly intercept traffic as it's crossing their borders. Now, I hate that idea. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting this is a good idea, but the technology exists to make that happen. Now, what would be better if something like this occurs is that instead an ISP could be required to reroute specific customer traffic to a law enforcement hub. That is, right now their ISPs have routers. They're routing traffic around. So imagine that in responding to a court order, an ISP is told to route a certain customer's traffic to a specific destination. Then law enforcement could have such a certificate, allowing it to seamlessly and essentially transparently intercept traffic. And there are still some downsides to that. For example, we know that Chrome has pinned the known Google certificates. So Chrome would set off alarm bells if there was a certificate from Google that this entity was trying to intercept and create on the fly. So either those PIN certificates could be made as exceptions, or Chrome could have the law enforcement interception certificate added to its permitted pinning in order to prevent alarm bells from ringing. So anyway, I wanted to share some further thinking and evolution of ways that it might be possible for the structure that we have today to be matured in order to allow, at least in the U.S., with the constitutional provisions we have against unwarranted search, but the need to be able to provide search warrant supervised interception of specific traffic where a court has decided there is cause, there are technical means by which that could be done in a way that would still largely protect everyone's privacy and even protect the privacy of those who are being surveilled by centralizing that to a degree that, frankly, there are already commercial entities like Google doing exactly the same thing. Google has the ability to mint certificates, and that same capability could be provided to law enforcement under some, you know, proper terms and conditions. A cryptography professor is wandering through a flea market and spots a typewriter for sale for 100 euros. But because he's a cryptography professor, he immediately recognizes it for what it actually is: an original Model 1 German Enigma machine.
No.
Being sold as a used typewriter.
Not a very good one at that.
No. It's like, where do you put the paper? How do you change the ribbon on this thing?
OMG.
He buys it for 100 euros.
Oh, yeah.
So he later sold it at auction, and the only way I can explain the low price he got, although he made a pretty penny, is that the purchaser certainly knew what it was, and they made off like a bandit. He sold it for 45,000 euros.
Wow.
The quote typewriter unquote that he purchased in a flea market for 100 euros.
Cow.
The reason, though, that was a good deal, although it must not have been in maybe super pristine condition, because I think that matters. Last month, the famous Christie's auction house in New York sold an Enigma machine for $547,500.
Wow.
So I have a feeling that was probably in mint condition with all of its little light bulbs working and, you know, probably fully functional. But yes, keep an eye out at the swap meet and the flea market and the garage sales for something that looks like a funky typewriter. You never know what
That's
you're going to find.
Wild. Was this was in Germany?
I think it was in I don't think I had it here. I've got the link to it. The BBC News covered
it, right?
Yeah, I know. It must have just been in somebody's garage it's like,
time to get in their garage. I mean, it wasn't
cleaning.
I don't think people just kind of, I bought an Enigma machine today.
Yeah, that's true.
Wow. Wow.
They're rare.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah. So, speaking of typewriters, this just sort of passed by. I just wanted to note on the topic of the that we are the product. We consumers are the product. Is that the standard keyboard on the HTC 10 has begun showing ads? Reddit had a long thread mildly infuriated people just sort of shaking their heads that, you know, now above all the keys and other little UI features there were ads beginning to appear on the HTC 10. So, yes, the
HTC
the look
said
of the,
that was a mistake. That was,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you know. Okay,
yeah,
good.
It just,
that good,
was
good.
Something went wrong.
That's freaky. I mean, I saw the screenshot of it, and it was quite a convincing mistake.
Yeah. Well,
good. Okay, so a squirrel update. I have been working on Squirrel's integrated install, update, and uninstall technology. It is integrated into the single XE. So essentially, the first and our listeners will be doing this before much longer. It's getting close. I did not use a separate third party installer because, frankly, Squirrel is, I think it's 287K or something, and the installers are multiple megabytes. So, you know, the installer would be, and it leaves debris behind and everything. So it just doesn't do anything that is necessary. So when you download it, you'll run it. Squirrel will pop up a screen. I notice I'm not installed. And you don't have to install. You could say no, and it'll just run from where it is. But if you install it, then you get some additional features. You have to have admin privileges. The installer that I have written is UAC friendly, so it understands about the split tokens we've talked about in the past that appeared with Vista, and then, of course, with Windows 7, 8, and 10, where you need to give permission in order to do something that's privileged by putting Squirrel into the program files tree. It protects it from some level of abuse, and it establishes it so that it puts an entry in the add remove programs in order to make uninstall easy. It gives it a presence in the start menu and so forth. So I did something that was cool, though, that is an example of one of the advantages of doing my own technology for this. And that is that, of course, the Squirrel executable itself is signed with an AuthenticCode certificate that, of course, I got from DigiCert. But that in itself, that is just having the executable signed with a certificate, doesn't itself provide the most security possible, since, you know, much of today's high quality trusted software is signed with AuthenticCode certificates. It raises fewer alarm bells when somebody runs something. GRC's certificate has established a reputation. So, for example, Never10 is signed with my DigiCert AuthenticCode certificate, and, you know, we've passed 2 million downloads. So Windows knows about stuff signed by GRC. And similarly, by AuthenticCode certificates, any random attacker could sign their own malware. So just the fact of it being signed actually doesn't provide much protection. To prevent that from happening, after downloading an updated version of the Squirrel client as a temporary file, it's Squirrel's self-updater not only validates that the new download's AuthenticCode signature is valid, but also verifies that the certificate was issued to Gibson Research Corporation and that the issuer was DigiCert. So, you know, the one step above doing that would be pinning to a specific certificate fingerprint. The problem with that is that certificates expire, as we know, deliberately every few years. So pinning updates to a specific certificate would require the updates to contain the fingerprints of not yet valid future certificates, and would force an update only for the purpose of updating the permission to update, essentially. So instead, what I've essentially done is I've pinned the certificate to the issued by and the issued to fields in the certificate. And, you know, there's just no way that an attacker is going to be able to arrange to get any sort of a squirrel malware spoof client signed by a valid AuthentiCode certificate issued to Gibson Research Corporation by DigiCert. That's not going to happen. So anyway, and so the beauty of this is that you download the first copy of Squirrel, and it will then keep a lookout for updates, notify you when there is one, and you press a button and it updates. What happens behind the scenes is that what is downloaded is not only has to be over TLS, has to be from GRC, has to be from a known location there, but once it comes down, then it has to be validly signed, and that certificate that it's carrying has to be from me and which I got from DigiCert. And if all of that is true, then it renames itself as the new client, and that goes into use. So a much stronger update technology than we normally see, you know, and I just did it because I could, because, you know, I was writing my own installer, updater, and remover. The install and uninstall is all finished. I'm just adding some little double check dialogues to the updater. Then that'll get done. I'll turn it loose to the gang in the news group to pound on. And then I'm down to a few little things. I've got a couple changes to the UI, and then I do have a to-do list that I've been accruing of just, you know, sort of mostly cosmetic stuff to deal with before I declare this thing finished. So we're getting very close.
Bravo. That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm excited, naturally. And of course, all of our SpinRite users are excited because once Squirrel is behind me, I return to work on 6.1. Which reminds me, apparently, I said SpinRite last week was approaching 40 years old. I meant 30. And I saw
that's
one
less
tweet.
Impressive.
Well, and I thought, how could I have said 40? And so I saw one tweet from someone who said, I think you said 40 and it must have been 30. And then I thought, I couldn't have said that. But then several other people also caught it. So clearly that was what I said. I just wanted to correct the record. Yes, 30 years old.
It shows you how much credibility means, you have with me, because I didn't doubt it for a minute. He must have started in his 20s.
That also means that Sue has been with me for about 32 years because she has been with me from even before the days of SpinRite. Speaking of SpinRite, I did see a nice note from Michael, who's in Glasgow, Scotland. And his subject was, what's heavier, 1 ton of zeros or 1 ton of ones? I thought, what? Anyway, he said, hey, Steve, longtime SpinRite user here. It's an amazing product that I, like many of your listeners, treasure. I was thinking about Oxford's question from episode 617 on whether it's better to SpinRite before formatting a drive or after. The intuition he had about it probably making no difference is interesting. You agreed with him, of course. My question is, does SpinRite take the same amount of time in both cases? Say that there's a 1 terabyte drive chock full of years of data and he write detritus.
Detritus, he means.
Detritus, that's right. I have a problem with that word, detritus. Thank you. But in good working order with no serious problems. Will SpinRite finish working in the same amount of time as a blank, completely empty 1 terabyte drive fresh out of the factory? I've never tried it, but I guess it must. He says, my gigantic folder structures and sizable data files have never felt so light. And so the answer is yes, until 7. My plan is to do a series of point releases, 6.1, 6.2, 6.3. And I'm not sure how far it'll go. Because it's taken me so long to get SpinRite or to get Squirrel finished and to get back to SpinRite, I'm going to push out a 6.1 faster than I had planned. That is, I'm going to make the changes I need to very quickly in order to get a 6.1 out. Then I'll do And that will fully support direct hardware access to the hardware that is the native motherboard AHCI controller. Or is it A-C-H-I? Advanced Host Controller, AHCI, Advanced Host Control Interface. I think 6.2 will then add support for the native USB controllers to allow attached storage to work much faster. I did, before I paused work on 6.1 to work on Squirrel, I did have the hardware running, the direct hardware interface running with a maximum size 32 meg buffer up from 32K, which is what SpinRite has always used traditionally, because that's the max that could be allocated. And it was running, it would be able to do, the code I have was able to do half a terabyte per hour. So it would do that 1 terabyte drive that Michael asks about in 2 hours. My plan, but none of the SpinRite 6 series knows about the file structure. SpinRite has always been a whole drive, surface analyzer and data recovery tool. With 7, I'm going to implement file level awareness to add things like rebuilding the file structure. But what that'll also mean is that it will be able to do selective file recovery and, for example, to verify the integrity of the data separate from the surface. So for the moment, to answer Michael's question, it doesn't matter whether there is a file system on the drive or not, which is why many people run SpinRite on brand new drives before even sticking it into a computer and establishing their operating system on it, because it'll run on a blank drive just fine. So anyway, Mike, thanks for the question and for bringing it up. Let's take a break, Leo, and then we will close the loop with our listeners.
Yes. Next week, how many holes it takes to fill Albert Hall. But first, a word from Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. I love it. Last week, I made butter chili steaks and fingerling potatoes. And I have to say, this is really a great, great thing. So what happens is you get a box with all the food, all the ingredients you need to make an amazing recipe. You choose the recipes. In fact, if you go to blueapron.com/securitynow and look at what's on the menu, you can see the variety of recipes for the week as we're doing this July 24th, but for your current week. They have a two-person plan and a family plan. The two-person plan feeds 2, the family feeds 4, with more kid-friendly ingredients. But I have to say, I found that we're a family of 3. We're right in the middle. The two-person plan is plenty for Lisa, me, and Michael. Look at this. Marinated beef pitas with sugar snap peas and radish salad. So let me just show you how this works here. So you get a card that tells you how to make it, plus every one of the ingredients to make it, and no more, no less. So you get... You need a cucumber, you get 1 cucumber. You need 2 cloves of garlic, you get 2 cloves of garlic. You need 1 lemon, you get 1 lemon. 4 ounces of sugar snap peas, 2 pitas. You get exactly the right. So this is nice because there's no waste. And by the way, everything is perfect. The meat is not frozen. It's fresh, but it comes in a refrigerated box. It is. They give you the little, like, movies online, how to prep sugar snap peas if you've never done that before. So it's kind of like a cooking class in a box. The lovely part about this is the house fills with these amazing aromas, roasted chicken and panzanella salad with sweet peppers and summer squash, or shrimp and fresh gnocchi with corn, basil, and charm tomatoes, summer vegetable tartine with cubanelle peppers and charm tomatoes. That's vegetarian. Coconut and lemongrass wonton noodles with mushrooms, bok choy, and peanuts. You choose the 3 recipes you want this week based on your dietary preferences, what you like, what you don't like. There's no weekly commitment. You don't have to have deliveries in it every week if you don't want. You get them exactly when you want them. Every one of these meals can be cooked in 40 minutes or less, and they're healthful, they're fresh, they're less expensive than shopping at the grocery store. And with no waste, you get exactly what you need to make just the right meal. I have to say, since I've been using Blue Apron, and you've noticed this, I've been cooking a lot more. It's got me back into cooking, even without the Blue Apron box. And of course, once you make a recipe, once you've figured out how to do something, it's a lot easier to go back and do it. We have a salad we make all the time now that we learned in Blue Apron. A cucumber and squash salad. Look at this. Spanish-style eggs with summer squash, piquillo peppers, and aioli. Oh, that looks so good. BlueApron.com. Look, you're going to get your first three meals free with your first purchase and free shipping. But you got to go to BlueApron.com/security now. Get the kids excited about dinner and about cooking. Get them involved. Get yourself reinvigorated. Make cooking fun again for you and get amazing meals that taste incredible. Better than going out. Go Blue Apron tonight. BlueApron.com/security now. Your first three meals are free with purchase. Did I get you hungry? My son's coming over. My son also is a big cook, and tonight we're going to be playing with the sous vide gear. We're going to do duck, and he's all excited about that. He just texted me. He said, what do I need to bring?
Cool.
I gave him a shopping list. I'm very excited. Yeah, it's fun. See, that's an example. Henry and I, that's a thing we've got now. We cook together. And that's really a good example of how this is good for families, I think. All right, on we go. Steve Gibson, you've got some questions.
So, yeah, just a couple nice bits of feedback from our listeners. Someone whose Twitter handle is Shady Hot Dog, but the name he has registered is This Is Nighthawk. He just said, DNS thingy is amazing. He said, flashed my Asus router with their firmware, and now I can do all sorts of cool stuff. Thanks, at SGGRC.
I think that's the Nighthawk who's a regular in our chat room.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And that's the DNS thingy that we talked about last week from the Nerds On Site guys, David Redekop, who also hangs out in the chat room, that uses DNS in order to perform all kinds of controls over people's local internet. Brian Lee wrote, Steve, my security conscious friends won't touch my mobile Facebook Live video streams. What's a good simple alternative? Oh. And Leo, I was hoping you would have an answer to that. Since I have no idea.
I wonder why their friends won't. Why his friends won't.
Says my security conscious friends.
Well, they just don't like Facebook, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's certainly many ways to stream. There's kind of, we stream on Ustream. That's free. We stream on Twitch.tv. That's free. YouTube Live. That's free. But I think if his friends don't like Facebook Live, they may not like any of those. I'm not sure. All four of those allow free live streaming. It depends what his friends don't like.
Yeah, I think maybe they just anti-Facebook. So right. you've just given us four good alternatives.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that probably answers Byron's question. Good. Thank you.
Periscope, Matt Warner. That's another one.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Matt Warner said, looks like Twitter disabled two-factor authentication using authenticators and now uses SMS only. Is it better not to use two-factor authentication at all? And I would say absolutely not. That is to say, it is better to use it. I mean, the fact that SMS is not as safe or secure as authenticator-based, time-based one-time passwords or one-time tokens, doesn't mean that it's not still better than nothing. So, it's a little worrisome that the 6-character SMS is being sent every time you need to authenticate. It would be nicer if that weren't the case, but it sure beats, but at least it's tied to your phone that's registered with your account and prevents an attacker from, just being able to arbitrarily log in if they somehow guess your username and password. So absolutely use, as much two-factor authentication as you can. Any is better than none. Jerry Yu followed up on our discussion last week about that Broadcom exploit, which was patched by Google in in earlier this month in Android to note that it looks like it was also patched by Apple. Remember, I said we did not know where Apple stood. It looks like it was patched in 10.3.1 because under the CVE number for that exploit, it reads Wi-Fi in Apple iOS before 10.3.1 does not prevent, and that's the CVE 2017-6556, stack buffer overflow exploitation via a crafted access point. So that's definitely the problem we were talking about, and it looks like they Apple did fix it in 10.3.1. So that's good to know that we don't have that baseband radio problem. Michael Rickman asked if I saw this, and he sent me a link, which was to yet another all-in-one credit card project on Indiegogo. And I just have to say, yes. And so far, I think I've been burned by three of them. And either
I warned
on
you about coin,
Kickstarter or Indiegogo. And I mean, and I, in fact, I did finally get an email from one of the first ones where the guy, I mean, I sincerely think, I know that he did everything he could, but I remember seeing a picture of his workshop. Like, you know, he was in the garage winding some coils or something.
Oh, boy.
And I remember thinking, oh, this does not look good. So the problem is, these electronic all-in-one credit card things, they are seductive, but it is very difficult technology. And so this is not something I would argue anyone should fund. I'm sorry, I don't mean to pour cold water on this, but you know, Indiegogo and it's not universally the case that Kickstarter and Indiegogo are people in their garage, but you know, as you know, Leo, as I have experienced, many of these projects never ship. And I will be very surprised if a small group are able to pull this off. If it's going to be done, it's going to be done by somebody, you know, by a much larger organization that can actually make this happen.
Now I'm going to say this is the one I want. This is the first one I've seen that uses a chip. It uses an EMP chip.
Yep.
See, that makes sense to me. It's not a Stripe card. It's an EM. I know, but you're right. It's hard to make. They've got $2 million raised.
Good. Let somebody else pay for it.
You've learned your lesson.
I'm not doing it again. No. There's just too many things that can go wrong. So
yeah.
as soon as it moves to, yes, we've actually shipped it and it works, then it's like, okay, Simon, I only use one credit card anyway. My best friend has a wallet that's probably throwing his back out. It's so thick, full of, because he travels for business, and he's got, you know, hotel cards and airline cards and all and rental car cards and everything. So yeah, I could see where for many people collapsing them into a single card would make sense. But
you have to charge this one every month too, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are downsides.
Yeah.
So someone named, I don't even know how to pronounce this, QREX. It was probably something that, you know, was available on Twitter. His name is QREX and his Twitter handle is at QREX. He said, confused, RESN619 HTML5. He wrote, so privacy and security are good unless it's media and it's between a company and their subscribers? Explanation?
That's a good point.
I know. It gave me some pause. And so I thought, okay, here's how I had to think about this for a while. Privacy and security are good unless it's media and it's between a company and their subscribers. Okay, valid point. The MPAA, let's remember, fought mightily to completely prevent the commercialization of consumer home recording. When that inevitably failed, content providers attempted to thwart the consumer's legal right to make copies of their legally obtained media. early analog VHS tapes were protected with a system known as Macrovision, which deliberately messed up the automatic gain control, the AGC, of recorders, preventing the duplication of such protected content. This also lowered the delivered quality of the result. But the publishers didn't care. It also didn't work to prevent copying. Before long, Macrovision stripping boxes appeared, which removed that protection. So it increased the cost of everything, reduced the quality of the result, and didn't prevent anyone who actually wanted to make a copy from doing so. Pirates continued to pirate. In the U.S., as we know, our copyright laws provide exemption for fair use. But Media DRM does not honor that right. The most famous example are probably DVDs, whose encryption was broken long ago. And early in this podcast, we talked about the problem, the fundamental problem of a DVD player needing to decrypt the encrypted disc in order to show it to you. The decryption has to happen there in your living room. So, yes, it can be cracked. And as, of course, we know, it was broken long ago, allowing owners now of those DVDs to legally, even if against the overtly restricted expressed wishes of the media's publisher, to rip and decrypt DVDs for more convenient and, I would argue, also more reliable, because we know DVDs don't last forever, storage and use. The silver oxidizes over time and a DVD can become unplayable. But if you ripped it and stored it on a hard drive, it can last longer potentially. And, of course, more recently, we have HDMI's HDCP, the High Bandwidth Digital Content Protection, which forces another significant compromise. Once upon a time, it was possible to instantly switch media sources and destinations in the blink of an eye. But that smooth operation has been messed up by HDMI's HDCP. Now, when switching, it's necessary to wait for at least several seconds for the endpoints to renegotiate their secure connection. And when that fails, as it occasionally does, you have to switch away and back again and hope. And DHCP limits cable lengths, which can be used reliably because it's the most finicky protocol in the entire system. And HDCP also has been completely bypassed. The market is chock full of $39 Chinese HDMI HDCP decrypting capture cards, which contain all of the standardized and well-known HDCP keys and render the entire system ineffective. If pirates wish to pirate, they can and do. But in the meantime, everyone else, all legal and legitimate users, suffer a significantly lower quality experience because the MPAA once again won their legislative lobbying victory. So, will the web be any different? Of course not. It will be every bit as possible for pirates to decrypt and capture web-delivered media as it has been for them all along the way. You can place your bets on that right now. The people who realistically understand this know that we're going to get a fragile and unnecessarily complex system, which will be less comfortable and convenient for legitimate and legal use, while doing little to actually thwart those who are intent upon pirating the web-delivered content. The bottom line is, what the MPAA and RIAA want is simply impossible for technology to deliver. Yet the money we have paid them allows them to continually screw up, with no apparent success, their media's delivery channel. So yeah, this is a bit different from protecting our logon password and session cookies. And that's our show.
Wow. Jam-packed with security goodness. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. When you go there, check out SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. That's his bread and butter, because everything else is there is free, including copies of this show. 64 kilobit MP3 audio, finely written transcriptions, so you can read along as you listen. And, of course, all that other great stuff he puts up there for all of Steve's wide and varied interests, including Squirrel and Perfect Paper Passwords and Password Haystacks. And there's a great password generator there. People keep reminding me, a great 64-character password generator.
Yep.
It's all there, GRC. It's fun to browse around, too. It's like Grandpa's attic. If Grandpa were a crazy
wonderful
security guru. Hey, we're the same age. I can say that.
Hey, no offense taken, my friend.
Uncle Steve's attic. How about that? We also have audio and video of the show if you want to watch Steve in action and see his mug and the mug. Just go to twit.tv/SN. By the way, twit.tv/Teespring for the T-shirt. The mug will be added soon. Steve gave his thumbs up. We put I admit peer pressure, but that's, you know, sometimes you have to.
It looks good.
I think it looks great. I can't wait to get one. We'll send you a few, too.
Cool.
If you go to twit.tv/SN, you can also subscribe there, and that's what I recommend. That way you'll get every episode. There are quite a few and many more to come. Steve's pledged to stick with us till 1,000. So a whole 380 episodes still to come. Twit.tv/SN, or use your podcast client, whatever you use to listen to podcasts, to subscribe. We do the show every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC, right after Mac Break Weekly. So if you'd like to watch live, I encourage you to do so. Twit.tv/live has live video streams on the services I mentioned earlier, plus audio streams. And we're on TuneIn. You can listen on your Amazon Echo as well. Oh, she wasn't listening, I guess. you can watch live by saying Echo or whatever your trigger word is. Watch Twit Live on TuneIn, and it will play for you. Sometimes you have to say Twit Live for some reason. I'm not sure why. You can also say Echo, listen to Security Now on TuneIn, and you'll get it that way. And that way you'll get the latest episode. That's kind of a fun way to listen while you're cooking or whatever else you're doing. Let's see. What else? Oh, if you're if you're watching the live stream, I would invite you to visit the chat room, irc.twit.tv, because you can play along with the home version of our show and all the crazy kids in there. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye, Steve, on Security.
Thanks, Leo. Bye.
Security.